You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a cold January morning in 1981, a knock on an apartment door began what would become one of the bloodiest crime sprees in Arkansas history. In the coming days, the bodies of newlyweds Larry and Juana Price, businessman Holly Gentry, and police detective Ray Tate were discovered. They had been executed in cold blood and discarded like so much trash. What kind of person murders four people in cold blood? Did the right one go to prison? The book that we're featuring this evening is Cold Blooded, a chilling true tale of terror, rape, and murder in the Arkansas River bottoms, with my special guest, author Anita Paddock. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Anita Paddock.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, Dan. I'm happy to be here talking to you.
Thank you so much. This is an incredible tale. Let's just start with where this Arkansas River bottoms that we're speaking, we refer to in the title, where this area is, and then introduce Juana Price.
Okay. Well, the area is in northwest Arkansas, along the Arkansas River, and there's an area called, just a little area called Kibler, the Kibler Bottoms, and a whole lot of people live there, and the land had been theirs for generations and generations, and but the Kibler Bottoms would be not a good place you wanted to go to at night time. Okay, so Juana Price was this real cute little girl from Flat Rock, Arkansas, and she married a boy that she met in high school that was where she attended in Lamar, Arkansas, and Lamar's not very much bigger than Flat Rock, Arkansas, but Juana had always wanted to be a nurse, and so she and her husband married right after high school, and they moved to Fort Smith, Arkansas, where there's a community college there with a nursing program. So she started that nursing program there, and her husband got a job at Baldor Electric, and they just were real happy together, and they lived in a real nice little apartment that was close to the campus, so she could walk, and it was owned by this fellow named Holly Gentry. He was a really nice guy, and they just hit it off as friends. And so Larry Price and Juana managed these apartments. And Holly Gentry's father owned this really nice big, it was a big mall in western Fort Smith called Phoenix Village. And and so during the Christmas vacations, they asked Holly if she'd like. They asked Juana if she would like to work part time while she's out of school, and be like a secretary there for them at Phoenix Village. And she said yes, she would. So on this Monday morning, the door. She heard a knock on the door, and she answered the door, and it was this guy standing outside, and he said he wanted to look about this car that was being for sale. And the car belonged to Holly Gentry, but Larry was selling it for his friend. So she said, Juana said, well, just wait here, and I'll get my husband. He's still asleep. So she got her husband, and they came out, and they took a test drive with his car, and when she was getting ready to leave to go to work, they got back, And her husband said, well, this is Mr. Simmons, and he wants to buy the car. And so she said, well, great. So it was time for her to leave for work, and Larry walked her out to her car like he usually did. He was a real sweet, good, kind husband, and walked her out. And so she left to go to work at Phoenix Village. And before she left, she and Larry decided that they would have lunch together and go eat lunch at a Mexican restaurant. And he'd pick her up at noon at Phoenix Village. So she went on to work. And when it came time for lunch, she went out and waited for Larry, and he didn't come. And that was really unlike him. And so she went back in, and she told the people she worked for that her husband wasn't there to pick her up. And that was strange. And so Holly Gentry said, well, why don't you call Larry's work at Baldor? That was an electric company, a big electric company, and see if he's at work. And so she did, and the lady who answered the phone there, the secretary, said, no, but he called in and said he wouldn't be there today. Well, that really scared her. So then she called his parents, and she called her parents to see if perhaps Larry had gone down there for some reason. And no, they hadn't heard from him. So Holly Gentry insisted that they go and make a report about Larry being gone. Also gone was and this car was gone also, the car that was in for sale. So they went to the police station, and they gave all the particulars, and they talked to these two police officers. One was named Poncho, and the other one was named Ray Tate. And they took all the particulars and said, why don't you all go on, you and Holly, go on back to the apartment, and we'll follow you and come back and get all the information about the car that has been just no longer around. So they went back to the apartment, and she was, of course, real concerned about her husband, where was he, and Holly Gentry was concerned about his friend and where was his car. And they got into the apartment, and there they were met by this Simmons guy who had come to look at the car to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And he took Ray Tate's gun, and he took his handcuffs, and he handcuffed him. And Joanna and Holly had already been tied up with some real heavy twine that he found in their house. And so there was the guy who looked at the car that morning, and his name was Mr. Simmons. And then there was Holly Gentry, and there was Joanna, and then there was Ray Tate. And the fellow named Poncho Davis, he had to go to a meeting, and so he couldn't go with Ray Tate, but he was going to come later.
Mm-hmm.
And so here they were in this apartment. It was on January the 5th, 1981. It was real cold. And Joanna was crying, and she didn't know where her husband was, and Holly Gentry was a real Christian fella, and was always talking about Jesus and wanting people to get right with the Lord. And so Holly was given this same spiel to this Mr. Simmons, and Ray Tate was just thinking that any minute now Poncho's gonna be there. And Pancho got held up at his meeting, or he would have been there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so here we have a man, we have a husband, Larry Price, missing, and the car that he was selling is also missing. And then we have Joanna, who is crying and hysterical because she doesn't know where her husband is, and she's scared to death. And then we have Holly Gentry, and we have Ray Tate. And Ray Tate was the kind of policeman who always said he could talk his way out of anything. And that was his persona, that he could always talk his, he could talk his way out of any kind of trouble. And he told his fellow police officers that. And so, anyway, Ray Tate and Holly Gentry and little Joanna. When I say little Joanna, Joanna was about 5 feet tall and weighed probably about 95 pounds. She was a real tiny little girl. Anyway, Mr. Simmons decided that he would take all three of them and put them in Ray Tate's vehicle, his police car, and they would all leave. And so they headed down. Mr. Simmons, his name was Thomas Simmons, and they called him Tommy or Tom. And he had Joanna sit in the front seat with him, and he had Tate and Holly Gentry lie down on top of each other in the back floorboard. And Ray Tate thought he would be able to get the ropes untied around Holly Gentry's arms and legs, and then he could get them untied around his, but that didn't happen. Anyway, they ended up down in the Kibler Bottoms. And so Simmons took him down there in the police car, and he shot them. He shot all three of them and raped Joanna. And then he put their bodies down in this kind of like a little trash heap that was on a farm belonging to Mr. McClure. And Mr. McClure the next day is who found the bodies of them. So they had to leave the bodies there at the crime scene until the state police was able to send a team there to take the bodies out and do all that they have to do. I'd like to read you a little bit about that crime scene, and while people are waiting. Okay.
Yes.
Night had fallen by the time the crime scene was roped off with yellow tape. A cold wind whined across the Arkansas River, which was just south of the murder scene. Men huddled in groups of four or five, quietly talking, shaking their heads, and wondering most of all who and why. The Arkansas State Medical Examiner's office in Little Rock had already been called, and nothing could be done until they arrived. Nothing but wait. The minutes dragged by into 3 hours, the time it took for the medical examiners to travel to the scene. The Kibler Fire Department drove a fire truck over to shine light on the murder scene, and later the Sebastian County Red Cross brought over a generator to supplement the power. A farmer delivered an empty barrel and a load of firewood in the back of his pickup so a fire could be built to warm those who waited. The news media was there also. Newspaper and television reporters jockeyed for positions while the lawmen tried their best to keep them at bay. Some of the locals who had farmed in this community for generations arrived with the feeling that their farmland was somehow desecrated. what has happened in our peaceful little community, folks ask. We all look out for each other, go to church, support our schools, try to raise our kids right. And now this. It was a scene few of them would ever forget as they stood in their insulated overalls and camouflage hunting coats. The flames in the barrel cast eerie shadows on their faces while they hunkered over the fire, holding their hands palm down, stamping their feet to get circulation moving, cursing the person or persons who would try to conceal bloody bodies inside a tractor tire. When the bodies were removed, everybody expected there to be four bodies because
right.
they knew that Larry was missing. But there were only three bodies. It was Joanna and Holly Gentry and Ray Tate. And so then that left one other person, and where was he? Where was he? And so they had a manhunt for Larry, and finally the next day or two, they got a message from somebody who had been on a drunken toot out close to the river bottom in this Clear Creek Park where people could go duck hunting. There was you could set your boat out and come in and out, and that was a good place for duck hunting. But anyway, they got this tip of where this body was, and that was where Larry was. And so then they figured out that this Simmons guy had stolen the car and taken Larry out to this Clear Creek Park, and he had shot him. And the strange thing, this guy, Simmons, he had stolen a check out of a checkbook at
right.
the apartment, and he wrote himself a check for $300, signed it, forged the name by Larry Price, and stopped on his way from killing Larry Price. He stopped at a bank and deposited this check, and it was
wow.
$300, and then he asked for $50 in cash, and so then he left. Well, he was doing all sorts of back and forth, taking a taxi cab here, taking a taxi there, putting this car here, putting his own personal car there, and he was just all over the place. I doubt that he could have done any of this by himself, but he was arrested because he was, when the next day, I'm getting ahead of myself, the next day after these murders and even before Larry Price was even found, they knew that all these people had been killed and that Larry Price was being looked, they were looking for him. And
right.
this Simmons guy, he very foolishly went back to the bank and said that he had deposited a check the day before, and he found out that it wasn't any good, and he wanted to get that check back. And so the lady who was waiting on him said, "Just a minute, I'll have to check on that." And by chance, her boss at this branch bank was the wife of the chief of police, the assistant chief of police. And so she, of course, had been hearing about everything from her husband. And so
right.
she got the license number of this car, and she called her husband, and he said, "Honey, you may have solved a crime of the century here." And so that's how they found this Thomas Simmons. He had a job, and they had the license number and knew where he worked. And so they went to his place of employment and picked him up and took him to the jail and arrested him.
Anita, let's stop for a second for these messages. Now you talk about his arrest. Now you talk about his arrest. They get his license plate number. They track him down. They get him at work. But now in your book, you recount the reasoning behind all of this and his criminal background, the things that he was on parole. So now we go back to Thomas, and we talk about him being paroled and his sister, Leona Powell. Tell us about the crime that he was on parole for, and then tell us about the details and the idea that his original plan was, he says later, that was his original plan for this car.
Well, his original plan, I'll start, he came from a real dysfunctional family, and he had been arrested many times since he was in, you know, for stealing a car when he was 17 years old, and his crimes just got worse and worse. And he had kidnapped this young man who worked at a filling station in Little Rock, and he made this man that he was working for him and filling up the tank. He had that guy get in the back seat of his car and lie on the floorboard, and off they went. And he ended up he thought he killed this fellow out in the country outside of Little Rock. And he tried to kill him. He tried to stab him to death, and that boy didn't die. Then he tried to slit his throat, and that boy didn't die. So finally, he just buried him under some leaves and thought that he had left the boy, that he was dead or going to die. Well, the boy, he was like 18, and he was strong and healthy, and he was able to drag himself to a nearby farmhouse, and they called the police and the hospital. And so this Simmons guy was identified and was arrested, and he was sent to prison for 45 years for kidnapping and a robbery and kidnapping and attempted murder. But he got out in 8 years for good behavior. So he had to find a place to stay. So he had a sister who lived down in Arkansas in Kibler Bottoms, and so he asked her if he could come and live with her while he was on parole. And she was a unwed mother, had 5 children. In fact, the youngest child actually belonged to Thomas Simmons, but she had adopted this little girl because Thomas Simmons was such a terrible person. Anyway, she had these 5 girls, and she was trying her best to give them a good start. And she did. The girls, the Powell girls, all were very capable young women, and were some. One girl was already going to school at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. The other two girls were going to West Ark Community College. And then there was the other girl was very popular in high school. She was she was head of the annual staff and put out the newspaper. Anyway, they were a nice family, and they got, and old Simmons came to live with them. And he thought that he could maybe redeem himself from his criminal ways, and And he had gone to, when he was in Leavenworth prison, he had gone to some classes and did very well in computers classes. So he wanted to go to the community college, West Ark in Fort Smith, and he got accepted, as a matter of fact. But he didn't have any money to pay the tuition or buy his books. And so I think that when he saw this car for sale, he thought he would steal that car, sell it to somebody he knew from prison days who would buy it, and then he would have the money and he could start his college education. That was what the rumor sort of was. But I do know that Simmons hung out at the West Ark in the Student Union. He hung out there. People remembered seeing him out there, and he had, you know, signed up to take some college courses. He wasn't dumb. He was when he was taking these college courses, he read, he took some English classes and literature classes, and you know, he knew the Grapes of Wrath. He knew all these American authors and War and Peace, and I mean, he was not dumb, but he was lived a life of crime, and there was no way he was going to get out of it. No way whatsoever. So when they found Larry Price's body, then that accounted for all the four people, and those were all sent down to for autopsies down in Little Rock. And this was a really sad thing. Little Joanna's face, while she was buried in that tire pit, there were some dogs down in there who had puppies, and her little face was eaten off by those dogs.
Let's talk about Leanna Powell, Thomas's sister, but she has a boyfriend.
She has a boyfriend. Yeah, she has a boyfriend. And Squeeb was from this big, large family, the Bryant family, in Kibler. And he didn't do much but just hunt and fish. And he was a real little guy, and he weighed about 120 pounds, and he was about 5'7" or so. But he and Leanna were girlfriend and boyfriend. And when Thomas Powell moved into Leona's house, well, they did some drinking together. And so everybody in the community, the Kibler community, when this happened, they all thought that Squibb was behind it, because he knew that they were friends. But Squibb was in Mississippi on a duck hunting thing with four or five men from around there. And so Squibb could not have done it unless those four or five men just made did an alibi for him. I don't know. But it was...
What about the gun? What was discovered by the police in terms of his connection to the gun?
Oh, okay. There was a gun at the bottom of the bodies that were found in that ditch or that little pit thing. There was a gun in there, and it was the same kind. It was the same gun that had been used to kill the people, and that gun was traced back to Squeeb, and Squeeb had. He 2 years earlier, he had gone and to the police department and declared that gun had been stolen. That was 2 years before. But you know, someone can say a gun has been stolen and then not, and then it really hadn't been.
Sure.
And so one of Mrs. Powell's, the sister's daughters, said that Squeeb had given her mother a gun because there were some prowlers around there. And so then her mother said, no, that didn't happen. Squeeb said, you know, he said no, he'd never given her a gun. But, you know, certainly the gun was available for Thomas Simmons to have used. They found all sorts of things. And, oh, this is one interesting thing. You know, Thomas Simmons took everybody out to Kibler Bottoms and Tate's police car. And he left the police car at this filling station at truck stop. And so a Van Buren policeman was patrolling the area, and he saw Tate's police car. Of course, there was all sorts of bulletins out to be looking for all these various cars. And so they looked under the chassis of the car and saw all this dirt and saw all these kind of weeds and mud and sand. They knew this had come from the Bottoms, but they didn't know if it was the Bottoms on the Van Buren, the Kibler side of the river, or on the Oklahoma side of the river. The Arkansas River divided Arkansas from Oklahoma right there at that particular area. So they were looking all over the place. They had police cars patrolling. They had airplanes patrolling, seeing if they could see anything. So it was quite a manhunt and quite a thing to have happened in Van Buren. However, as it turned out, it was the third crime that had happened in a 9-month period of time in Van Buren. And I had written about the other two crimes, and I didn't realize that there had been that many crimes in one time, but when I started working on it, I realized that, hey, this all happened in a 9-month period of time in sleepy little Van Buren, Arkansas. Population then was about 8,000, maybe.
Right. So let's get back to Pancho Davis, and now he's been arrested. Now this Thomas has been arrested.
Okay.
They certainly have a lot of circumstantial evidence. They also have witnesses that place him looking at the vehicle prior to this, to the abduction of Larry Price in the first place. So they have various witnesses. They even had a couple witnesses that identified him in a lineup. So they have some strong circumstantial evidence. Tell us a little bit more about the prosecution and their idea about what happened, despite you mentioning that it looked like, to anybody that looked at this and anybody had heard about this crime, that there certainly was the possibility that Thomas Simmons had a partner.
Well, yes, because I don't know how one man could corral a policeman, Ray Tate, and then Holly Gentry. They were both in fine physical shape. Let's see, Holly Gentry was 28. The Tate fellow, I think, was 32, and then this little Joanna. I mean, anybody could, you know, toss her around. She was so little. Here is one kind of a little anecdote about Joanna. Joanna was scared to death to be in that apartment by herself.
Right.
She was always scared. And her friends who were in nursing school with her, they would study together, and she would always ask the friends, to walk home with her and go into the apartment with her. And while she looked in the closet and looked under the bed. And so this little girl, she had some kind of premonition that something was bad going to happen to her. You can imagine how scared she was. She didn't know where her husband was. The police found in the police car, in Tate's police car, they found some matchbooks, and they found some cigarette packages. It was Vantage cigarettes. I don't even remember Vantage any, but this is, you know, back in 1981. And then some matchbooks that said good value on the matchbook covers. And those were found in Thomas Simmons' trunk of his little car. He had his little orange little Toyota, and that was found in there. Those matchbooks and the cigarettes. They never found any bloody clothes to tie Thomas Simmons in, but if his sister had washed his clothes as she normally did, because he worked at a sand and gravel company and got, you know, every day when he came home he was covered with, you know, sand and stuff, and she always did that, or so she said she always did that. She might have been lying for him. She might have been scared of him.
Made a good point, though. You might have made a good point, though, in that he seemed to have the technique, because as you read in the book, Billy Gentry was a very fit guy, and cryptically he had a conversation with his other physically fit brother, and they were talking about the Iran-Contra hostage affair, and they talked specifically about that they would rather, and they knew that it would be better to die where you were taken hostage rather than to go with the kidnapper. And they had this strangely cryptic conversation. And the thing is that Detective Tate was another person that wouldn't have went without a fight, wouldn't have stopped planning right to the very end to be able to escape. And then you write as well that that Juana was the last to die. And so you talk about her personality. So imagine the horror. And as you write in the book, too, he rapes her. And that, as you write, and I want to talk about this a little bit, she is not only, she's raped anally and vaginally.
Right.
Let's talk about this John Dickerson, because you zero in on this person as this person that was willing to be an accomplice in terms of this stolen car of Larry Price. Tell us what you think happened.
John Dickerson was someone I just gave a name to, because all the time I was writing, when I was writing this book, I always felt like he had an accomplice, because he wanted to steal this car, and then he had to sell it because he himself couldn't be driving around with his car when he was wanting to go to college and had already signed up and already gotten admitted. And so I just thought, well, there has to be somebody who's helping him along. And there was one man who, earlier in the book, he is interviewed by some police, because he claims that he saw Simmons escort these three people out to get in the car. He said he claimed that he was there taking care of someone's apartment while they were gone. And he claims that he was walking out there and saw it all. But not much. Nobody really believed him all that much because he actually was a schizophrenic and had been in and out of mental hospitals. And so they sort of, the prosecuting attorneys, they claimed that he didn't, you know, that his memory could not have been that perfect. I don't know. I don't know about that fella. I do know that just a few months ago, I visited with Holly Gentry's sister, and I had gotten all of the Gentry information from the brother Mark, who told me everything that I knew about the Gentrys. Anyway, his little sister, had she wanted to meet me. She and her husband live up in Missouri, and so she told me that she'd like to meet me, and so I met her. Well, it's been a month ago, I guess. I met her at a bookstore, and she told me that after all this happened, that the Van Buren police had found up in a vacant house up on Highway 59, they had found Holly Gentry's wedding ring and Holly Gentry's wallet and Tate's wallet up in this house, up in this house that was for sale and was vacant. And so somebody connected with Simmons was in that house. And that further makes me think I was correct in thinking that somebody was staying in that house and helping out Simmons with his various shenanigans that he was doing, killing people left and right.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now you talk about this, and you talk about this and new information coming out, like you say, just recently. This book was published in 2019. Let's talk about this trial. This is a capital case trial in Arkansas.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what happens. You have the prosecutor has a story, and of course, the defense has a much simpler, much different story.
Well, the defense, Simmons was, he had a court-appointed attorney, and that was John Settle. And John Settle, you know, a court-appointed attorney isn't really keen on having to do that. They only get $200 to present their case, or at that time they did, and so he doesn't think he can do a very good job. And then the prosecuting attorney, Ron Field, he interviewed all these people who had seen Simmons and come and look at the car and had seen Simmons at hanging out around West Ark, had seen Simmons hanging out at the Osco drugstore in the shopping center where he was going here and yonder from a taxi cab. He interviewed lots of people, and they were the ones who were really the most interesting, I thought, and I had the transcript of the trial, so I had a really good treasure chest of notes to use, and so I had all the transcript of all the questions that were answered, and Simmons did not take the stand. This is an interesting aside from that. They filed, of course, all sorts of appeals that are automatically filed. And then Simmons, he wrapped himself up in a blanket and slit his throat and committed suicide. Now, I don't know why in the world you would wrap yourself up in a blanket, and I don't see how in the world you could slit your own throat. I think he might have. Now, have you heard of the Dixie Mafia?
Yes, it's been discussed on
okay.
the podcast.
Okay. Well, the Dixie Mafia is just a group of bad folks who originated down in Mississippi, and I know that they killed a judge down there, but they're just a bad. They would be like the mafia, the Dixie Mafia is the bad folks who live in the South and commit crimes and they're just bad folks. And now Simmons was in prison so many years, obviously with somebody who was probably, it would stand to reason that he might know somebody in the Dixie Mafia. And so it could be that this, whoever he was going to sell the car to was part of the Dixie Mafia. I don't know, but I could just, toss that out from a thinking. And so it also could be that Simmons took the rap for killing everybody instead of it really being some Dixie Mafia people. Now, that's another thing to toss out. And Simmons was a cellmate of this fella who I wrote about in my second book, who had killed these people who he had robbed a jewelry store, and he had killed a man who owned the store and his daughter. And
right.
Supposedly that fella killed those people was part of the Dixie Mafia. And so if he was a cellmate of this Simmons guy who might have, pleaded that he took the fall for these other guys, he could have killed him. He could have wrapped him up and slit his throat. I don't know.
Well, you're right.
You're
right that you have your doubts about whether it was an actual suicide, and then you talk about a Eugene Perry and that his connection to the Dixie Mafia. I don't know about the ideas that you speculate, but there are various reasons for being killed in prison. But I think your idea that it's unlikely a suicide, you write that why would he wrap himself in a blanket beforehand? So there was at least some questions as to that as well. Ironically, if he were to commit suicide this way by slitting his own throat, it's very similar to what DA tried to do with the young boy. Unfortunately, didn't kill that boy by slitting his throat. You talk about the trial itself, capital punishment. The prosecutor did an admirable job. John Settle, the defense attorney, basically said that all they could really prove that he had forged a check, that initial check that he had stolen, that blank check. But you say very much that that was his undoing. And that trial, along with the circumstantial evidence and the witnesses that placed him in various places, that he did receive that capital punishment. And then once his appeals were exhausted, that's when you say that this slitting of the throat suicide occurred.
Well, suppose he told somebody, Simmons told somebody, that he was going to commit suicide because he didn't want his family to have to go through being talked about when his electrocution date was set. He didn't want them to have to go through all that again, which seems sort of flimsy to me, because when he did commit suicide, that was, you know, that brought about some speculation as well. I don't know. You know, after, now I'm from around here, and so, I mean, I was born in Crawford County. My daddy had a store, and all of his customers were farmers in Kibler, and so I know a lot of people around here, and which has sort of made it easy for me to be able to write these books about crimes that have been committed here, because I'll know people whom I can talk to and they'll tell me things. And so I really don't know how, I really don't know if Ron Fields, the prosecuting attorney, if he knew some things, but he just, you know, he might have just not wanted to have gone through it all and just said, oh, this guy did it and just be done with it. Because he was taking care of some other, there was a trial that was coming on after him, after this was completed with the, I don't know, sometimes...
I think in my experience I've seen is that what happens with the prosecutor is that very much like anyone that could look at this looked like that there was likely a partner. If you looked at Squeeb and Squeeb had a people willing to testify and did testify that he was in Mississippi hunting, I'm pretty sure because of that connection with the gun, they would have liked him to be that second person. Now, the other person, the car thief, as you write, really didn't have any other record other than car theft. But the other thing that I see over and over again is that the prosecutor does not want to introduce a possible other person to throw, again, the prosecution or give the witness an opportunity, pardon me, the defense an opportunity to say, well, how about this other person, and to cast the focus off of their own client in sort of a confusing manner, because you only need one person to hang a jury. So very much so, I think that what this is, they have a clear prosecutorial focus. This is the person. We have the evidence against him. He certainly did do it, and we're going to deal with that person. And they can always, and they do have the opportunity to charge somebody further if they gain more information. Especially, I think that would be the case when they're dealing with making sure that this guy, unlike the very first time when he got 45 years, that this person was going to not exit jail anytime, period.
The guy who was the prosecuting attorney when Simmons got out in 8 years, when he was supposed to serve 45, that prosecuting attorney just incidentally was the governor of Arkansas at one time.
Yeah, and it was interesting that he, at the advent of parole, tried to intervene and say that this person was at least beyond rehabilitation and dangerous and not to be let out. And they went against his recommendation.
Right. I don't know. One person told me, this lady who used to work at the courthouse, she thought there was a lot of skullduggery going on, and that why did Simmons get to come and stay at his sister's house, and why did this happen, and Squeeb was, he had all these fish fries all the time for people, county officials, and maybe, you know, there was all sorts of like, how come this guy really got to go to his sister's house? And this is one more thing. The sister, every time she was subpoenaed to testify, she didn't show up. She said that she was sick. She said that she had fallen down. And so they just forgot. They just said, well, we just won't testify against her. But now had somebody cross-examined her pretty well, they might have found something out.
Yeah. What's very disturbing, too, is when you take the reader into the crime scene, and we didn't get into it, but you talk about what likely Juwana said, what likely was said to Thomas from Holly Gentry, being the Christian that he was. But Tate, one of the most disturbing things was that his own handcuffs were used to subdue him. And
yes.
And all of these people were shot in the back of the head by the perpetrator putting up the coat of the jacket. And you write in the book that all of them were likely, if not for certainly, begging for their life, asking if they would be killed, and he would assure them that, no, I'm not going to kill you. Of course I wouldn't kill you. I'm not going to kill you. And it was a cold-blooded killing.
It was cold-blooded. The book title, I took, Cold-Blooded, came from one of the Supreme Court when they ruled that he had his last appeal. The Supreme Court ruled that they had never seen a more cold-blooded killer than this fellow was. And so that's where I got the title Cold-Blooded. Not that I'd never heard of cold blood before, but the Supreme Court had used it. So, this book, I may know some more later on, just like I found out from the sister that they had found his wedding ring and his wallet. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. I also wanted to mention, too, that you are the author, and you had alluded to it, that you are the author of Closing Time and also Blind Rage, which just happened to be about this area, Van Buren, where you are from, and also a particularly murderous time in the history of this area, because this happens in a short period of time, these sensational three murders that you chronicle in your books, Closing Time, Blind Rage, and now Cold-Blooded. A very interesting time and history of this little area.
The Blind Rage was that was the first one I wrote. That was just a good story. I knew because I knew everybody involved in that. And I just remembered when it all happened. I thought, oh, man, I'm going to write this book sometime. And so when I wrote that book, Blind Rage, I really wasn't thinking I'm going to write a true crime book. It just ended up by being true crime. Well, that book did so well that I thought, well, maybe I will write another true crime book.
Mm-hmm.
And then, they kept appearing, and I'm working on this. I've got another one that I'm working on right now that actually takes place over in Fort Smith. So, not too far. No.
Because Fort Smith plays prominent in this story as well. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, Dan, it's been fun talking to you. Boy, I'm telling
Thank you,
you,
so
you
much.
Really are. You're a thorough reader. Everything you brought up, I thought, "Woo, he is a thorough reader." That's amazing. How many of these books you have to read in order to talk to the authors? I'm impressed.
Well, it's a pleasure, though. The book was so good, and it was so disturbing to bring the reader, like I say, right into the kidnapping, the rape, and the abductions, and these people begging and pleading for their lives, and all the horror that Juana experienced thinking about her husband and having that trepidation and premonition that something was going to go wrong, and it certainly it all did. Not a happy ending whatsoever. But I want to thank you so much, and Anita Paddock, for coming on and talking about A Cold-Blooded. And I would recommend people go and look at your Amazon page for Closing Time and for Blind Rage as well. Thank you so much,
yes.
Anita.
Uh-huh.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.